more likely, more intense, and longer lasting. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 87 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 83 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Spangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
In Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 14th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on El Paso, Texas, to tell the story of Natividad Zavala Zavala, a Honduran woman's agonizing separation from her seven-year-old grandson as a result of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy and the upcoming opera depicting the hardship she faced. This month, President Joe Biden signed an executive order that would temporarily shut down the U.S.-Mexico border and suspend protections for migrants seeking asylum. The executive order is likely to face legal challenges and has been described as the most restrictive border policy issued by any recent Democratic president. Yet while the legal and political ramifications of these decisions are sure to be challenged, the human costs of such immigration policies have gone grossly under the radar. It is especially frustrating when it seems like the stories of family separation and children in cages not long ago have been suddenly forgotten. Which is why our guest today will remind us about the human cost of cruel migrant policies that have yet to be resolved. And so with us on the show today is Ana Dini Morales. She's the librettist of the upcoming opera Zavala Zavala, and also a Latin American Studies Fellow in the Humanities and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Ana Dini Morales.
Thank you so much, Oscar. It's an honor to be here with you and Sergio Garcia.
Absolutely. With that said, we also have with us as a guest Sergio Garcia, who's an assistant federal public defender for the Western District of Texas, and whose own personal experience in this case lends itself to the opera as well. Sergio Garcia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you, Anna, for being with us also.
There we go. So there's a lot to discuss here. The timeliness of having this discussion is so important, Anna. But before we get in depth with the greater implications of recent events, can you first tell us about the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala, as well as the opera that was inspired by her story?
So Zavala Zavala, an opera in five cuts, which is a work that premiered in 2022 with the In Series at the Kennedy Center and is going to be performed happily again here in Washington, D.C. at Gala Hispanic Theater on June 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. This project as an operatic work began in 2017, or actually 2018, when Brian Ariola, who's the composer of the piece, and he's a professor of voice and opera at UNC Charlotte, commissioned me to write a one-hour work about the separation of families at the Mexico-U.S. border. He's told me I could write about whatever I wanted regarding what was happening at the border. And I decided that, among many things, what was striking to me was the battle of language involved in this situation. So I was really interested in what was going on legally. And this interest comes from a lot of places, but one of the places I'd like to pinpoint that interest in is I heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg say that opera represents, when we hear the opera, we hear the human voice going through us. And she says that justice and mercy are there in that form. And she also said that she wanted to be a vocalist. But it occurred to me that what she was a great librettist, because she expanded the law's capacity to hold and represent the breadth of what is a human voice, right? The great infinite variety of what the human voice is. Ruth Bader Ginsburg expanded that capacity within the language of law. And so these issues of justice and mercy and truth and the human voice really stuck with me. And so I wanted to see what was going on with regard to the legal battle being waged at the border, and not just at the border, for example, also with regard to the Flores settlement during this period. So I started to investigate, and I came upon the case of the El Paso Fives, and I started reading about Mr. Sergio Garcia and how the administration had actually run a pilot program in 2017 to test the resilience of the juridical system vis-a-vis this directive of the separation of families. So the question would be, would people really go through with taking children away from their family members? And then what would happen to a legal system, to the individuals in a legal system, when they realize that children have actually been disappeared and are unaccounted for? And so I found the legal proceedings, which you can find online. I found the legal proceedings of Sergio's case and the El Paso Five. And as I was reading the legal proceedings, I realized many things, among them that the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala and her grandson, who was separated from her after she crossed the Rio Grande, her grandson, who was 7 years old at the time, and Ms. Zavala Zavala was 65 years old at the time. I realized that this situation in particular was really striking for Sergio Garcia. And I could just tell it through reading his language in the document. And I could also tell in the document that the case read like a tragedy, that Mr. Garcia was not going to win that case. I felt it. You know, my training is I'm formally trained as a pianist. I grew up singing and performing Caribbean music. So I have a musical training. And then I'm also trained in language. And I could read that this read like a tragedy. You know, no matter all of the arguments, the legal arguments that Mr. Garcia put forth, which were outrageous government conduct, testifying under duress in the sense that those individuals' children were being held without knowing where the parents or family members, not knowing where the children were, which is a form of torture and also violates the Flores settlement. So there were many arguments that were clearly being transgressed by the government and said Sergio was not going to win. And then there was another level. So first, his particular interest in the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala, the fact that he wasn't going to win the case, and you can tell that and you can feel it in the documents. And then the third thing is that there's a materiality to language. And I could tell that Mr. Garcia was being interrupted several times. It's like he couldn't get a word in edgewise.
Really?
So there you see, and you see it in the documents. He said, if you will only, and then the court will say, let me interrupt you briefly, right? And then Mr. Garcia will say, if you will only let me, you know, so there are moments like that throughout the entire document where I could tell that he, as a human, was extremely frustrated, extremely concerned about what he was realizing what was happening, which is that children had been disappeared, which disappeared means that they're unaccounted for. So this was something that Mr. Garcia was going through. And so I found him somehow through Google searches and, you know, like finding the building where he worked. And then I looked up the other names on the legal document and I thought, wow, these people all work together. What is happening? What is happening among these people who are working together? And then I asked him, I managed to get his email address and asked him for an interview. And without telling him, in the interview, he confirmed with me that this was a case that had struck him emotionally, spiritually, in his profession. And so that's what I ended up writing about.
That is amazing. And what really caught my attention right there is the concept of justice and mercy, because mercy isn't brought up often enough as it should when it comes to the immigration debate in this country, especially during the zero tolerance policy era. And I have to say, before we go to Sergio, that when we talk about the damage done by family separation and zero tolerance, we shouldn't talk about it in the past tense. It's still in the present tense. There has not been any declaration by this current administration that all the children that were separated in this time period have been reunited with their families. That has not happened. It has yet to be resolved. And that's why we need people like Sergio Garcia who fight the good fight in fighting these cases. So Sergio, according to the El Paso Times, the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala came around a time in 2017 when the zero tolerance policy was not as well known, certainly as it is now. So can you tell us two things here? One, what is the El Paso Five as it pertains to this case? And if you could explain to us the significance of the case in raising awareness to a policy that had otherwise gone unnoticed up to that point.
Yes, El Paso Five is a case that came to me initially as a sort of an obscure case, because in my profession, I've been an attorney for over 20 years, and all I do is criminal law, and I handle felonies all the time. And so this particular time was a little different because I was given misdemeanor cases, and I thought I was being demoted. But after talking to my boss, I said, no, I want you to handle these cases, and it's about immigrants, and I'm an immigrant. And I didn't think it twice, but Anna is correct. And to say that I wasn't going to win from the get-go, I thought it was a tough battle. However, I held by the Constitution, and that was my hope, right? Obviously, what we see today, the Constitution is in trouble. But I didn't know in 2017. So I saw these five immigrants. I read about them and quickly went to the jail. And Anna is correct. When I spoke to this grandmother, who could not even write in Spanish, she had a hard time grabbing a pencil or a pen when I needed her signature. I think she signed with an X. I can't remember how it was, but it was just, and to see her telling me that I was her only hope, there was no way I could decline the case. She was along with other four immigrants, and we put them together as one case, thinking we could have more strength. And we raised really good issues. We didn't know what's going on. But what we knew was that these kids were taken away from their parents, and in this case, from the grandmother. And it was really remarkable to see this grandmother telling me that in the middle of the night, some officers walk into the cell. She was sleeping on the floor. with a blanket with her grandson. And one officer grabbed the grandson and told her about 2 in the morning, say goodbye because we don't know if you're going to see him again. And to see her cry and to lean on me for this hope, and I placed the hope in the legal system. I thought that the arguments that I raised were basically 5 issues. And they weren't hard to really, you didn't need to go to law school to understand that it was cruel and unusual, right? So that's the 8th Amendment. It was really cruel and unusual to separate you permanently from your child for the commission of a misdemeanor, right? That it was also unfair because you had not been convicted yet. The presumption of innocence should prevail. It was an outrageous government conduct. And perhaps one of the most important things for me was, as a lawyer, when you have the right witnesses, you can win cases, even as a defender. And in this case, we need the most important witness. We needed the children. We needed the child to take the stand and say, hey, yes, we left our countries because we were in danger. And that's why we cross. And so had the jury been able to hear from these witnesses, if I would have put this 7-year-old grandson on the stand, and I would ask him, why did you guys leave Honduras? I have no doubt whatsoever that the jury would be compelled to side with the defense, right? But, you know, I had no witnesses. So this material evidence, which, you know, is material, was hidden from us. And worse yet, it was hidden in places that they didn't even know where they were hiding them. So it was a horrible case. Legally, with foundation, we went to the district court. We lost in the district court after going to the magistrate. And then we took it to the Fifth Circuit. And I do remember one thing about the argument in the Fifth Circuit. I argued before the appellate courts. I argued in the Tenth Circuit. I argued in the Ninth Circuit. And I argued in the Fifth Circuit. And, you know, my wife usually goes to my arguments and usually she criticizes my argument. And I remember we left and she said, oh my gosh, you got to win this one. This was just the government's lawyer, the opposition didn't even know what to say. This is in the bag. And Ms. Zavala is going to be reunited somehow. So I was so happy. I mean, I think we went to dinner in New Orleans and we were just like, yes, yes. And then we lost. And so, yeah. You know, I had cases with people die. I have kidnappings. I had all kinds of criminal federal cases that you can imagine, and very tragic ones, very, very cases that are really, really hard. But without a doubt, the case that even till today bothers me, and I think it traumatized me a little bit because, you know, it's hard not to think of this woman who is now 70 years old and she's still, you know, this was her son. And obviously there is some sort of a consolation to tell her that they're together, that she's together, that her daughter's together with the grandson. But, you know, I'm sure that as a grandma, she still wants a hug. And I can't deliver that, and I couldn't deliver that. So that was the El Paso Five. Obviously, later on, it became apparent that it was actually called the zero tolerance policy. And it was on the news. It was morally and legally wrong, and then Trump left. But like you were saying earlier, it hasn't gone away, and there is a chance that it might come back. And that concerns me a lot.
What bothers me about this case, to be quite frank, is that there are probably thousands of Zavala type cases still going on, even as we had this conversation today. Certainly in the last few years, especially when the zero tolerance policy came about. And it really strikes me to hear, you know, somebody say that they're going to take your child and we don't know when you're going to see them back again. That's a very chilling thing to say to a grandmother. And it sort of leads me back to something that I think Anna said in a different interview, which is that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that this system of separating families was done by otherwise good people in other facets of their lives. You know, I'm paraphrasing again. So it just leads me to go back to what I said at the beginning, because recent events that have taken place in the last month alone are sort of unavoidable as we have this conversation here. So Anna, through the lens of somebody like Natividad Zavala, What do you make from recent events in terms of humanity or lack thereof? Because, again, I want to stress that the lack of humanity in this current debate is completely lost. It's mostly political and legal. And the idea of somebody's telling a grandmother that you may never see your child again, that person may be good at some other facet of their life. They may be a good parent. They may be a good brother or sister. They may be a good child in any other facet. It just strikes me how the system can dehumanize people once they enter it from the other side with regards to law enforcement.
So you asked earlier about the issue of the form, the operatic form. So in the commission, in Brian Ariola's commission to me, he said that he had a budget for 1 hour and 3 vocalists. So that was my challenge. How was I going to speak about something substantive with that amount of time? And I was looking through my drafts, you know, my folder with all of the research surrounding this opera. And when we speak of the border, everybody who's listening knows this. We speak of the border, we are speaking of a geographic and temporal landscape that's enormous. And in a way, ever expansive, right? And so with an hour, I realized that I didn't have time. For example, I thought of talking about the Flores settlement. You know, like I thought of calling the work Flores, Flores, exclamation point. But I realized I didn't have time to go that far back. I could only tell one story. I only had the time to tell one story. And the story is really exemplative of everything you're saying. And also, it reflected two groups of people that are the most precarious, and that's our elders and our youth, right? Those are the two groups of most precarious people that we are charged with caring for. And so the exposure of those individuals was striking to me, okay? So that's why, you know, when you say that this has happened to thousands of people in this particular case, that's why it's only telling the story of Natividad Zavala Zavala and Sergio Garcia and Natividad's grandson and this other lawyer who represents a group of lawyers who were representing the government's position. This issue regarding that you said before in your opening, you said the human cost. And something that has really taught me a lot about this issue of the human is Gabriela Mistral, who was our first Nobel Prize in Latin America, was, in addition to being a poet and essayist, she was also a diplomat, and she, more than anything, advocated for the rights of children and their education. And when, during the Spanish Civil War, when thousands of children were forced to leave from Spain, she eventually wrote a book called Tala, which is the last book she wrote before she won the Nobel Prize in the 40s. And basically an essay at the end of that book, she writes that it really surprised her that Latin American countries, except for Mexico, would not receive these children. So other countries received these orphans, these migrants, but Latin American countries largely did not receive them except for Mexico. And she said it surprised her of her people. And what that taught me was two things. First of all, who you are as people is determined by the treatment of children, even if those children are not biologically yours. So your humanity is defined. Humanity itself is defined by the treatment of children. Again, whether they're biological or non-biological. That's the first thing. The second thing is that what a border incites is the challenge between humanity and citizenship. And in our case, we're privileging citizenship over humanity. Although something that I've heard Mr. Garcia point out is that he just needs laws to be enforced, even for people who are citizens. So he really holds on to law itself as a form of hope, right?
Right.
But the third thing is that Catherine Donato, Professor Catherine Donato, who's going to be one of our speakers in the shows at the end of next week, she's a professor of migration at Georgetown. And one thing that she advocates for and speaks a lot about is the difference between criminalizing children in particular, or anyone who presents themselves at our border, versus considering their needs considering the needs of people and particularly considering the needs of children who present themselves at our border. And she also points out the fact that law itself does not take children into consideration, that law itself was written for adults. So there's this enormous silence regarding the need to account for children as humans. So it's important that you use that as humans with needs, with special needs in any situation. And the last thing is you remind me of Javier Zamora has this beautiful work called Solito, from as his voyage as a child from El Salvador. And one thing that I always ask my students to pay attention to is how he says, I need to be held. You know, Mr. Garcia said she wants to hold. It's just a very basic need. We need to be held.
Yeah.
We need to be held. It's the only sense you can't thrive. You cannot thrive without being held. Right? You can thrive without being able to see. You can thrive without being able to smell or taste or hear. But you can't thrive without touch. And so humans need that. And the drive to come north is violence. And it's also to be for people to be with the people they love. It's what we need as humans. But your more specific questions, I know I took a roundabout route to get to your more specific question. One thing that's really important to keep in mind, and I think Sergio can speak to this more than anyone, is that the zero tolerance directive does not occur within a vacío, right? The zero tolerance directive is a part of many attempts to regulate migration, slow it down, criminalize it. And it's just another example of the treatment of children at the border, right? That began before the Trump administration and continues after the Biden administration. Not to mention the fact that family separation is how the Americas was founded. To subjugate a people, to enslave populations, you have to separate them from their family. It's a strategy of power.
You struck me again with another key word here that I haven't heard since the last time I did a show on El Paso, and that is events like these don't happen in a vacuum. The last time I did a show exclusively on El Paso was around 2019 when the unfortunate mass shooting took place in El Paso, the largest shooting against Latinos in this country. And the guest I had at the time, a historian from El Paso, said the exact same thing, that those sort of hate crimes, these sort of events don't happen in a vacuum. And he was also referencing around that same time sort of the Bath riots in El Paso back in 1918, which shows that these discriminatory actions towards this immigrant community, whether it be from Mexico or Central America or South America, don't happen in a vacuum, en un vacío, as you said right there. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Ana Dini Morales, who's a librettist of the opera Zavala Zavala, as well as a Latin American Studies Fellow in the Humanities and adjunct professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. We're also speaking with Sergio Garcia, who's an assistant federal public defender for the Western District of Texas. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Empelagatos 2014. Yeah. Papá, original, inédito acá, escucha. Calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca, no dejes el camino y camina. Calma y respira, mira pa'lante y sigue, no cedas, traga saliva. Calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca, con eso de las cosas de la vida. Calma y respira, mira pa'lante y sigue, no
no te dejes caer. Te duele cada centímetro de la piel, te duele el cuerpo. Sufrís desde que amanece hasta el anochecer. Lo sentís muerto, sentís como una daga afilada clavada en el centro. Sentís como que nada te conduce a nada, como a ningún puerto. Respira, no pienses tanto que la mente se te pira. Sé que es difícil cuando sientes como que no hay salida. Elige el camino incierto, elige cambiar de puerto y verás que pronto cambia la energía. Sé que te duele la vida, yo sé que te duele tanto, y con mi canto quisiera darte comida y también de beber para compensar todo el agua que perdiste llorando tanto ayer hasta el amanecer. Aquí estoy yo, incondicional como siempre. Mi nombre es la Miss, la que te pide que te centre. Vengo cortando el dolor como con un sable. Tengo una nueva canción porque pedían que hable. Entonces traigo mi receta magistral. Sano tu mambo con mi combo, exorcizando el mal. Así nomás, en un solo canal, empieza el ritual y el mantra que dice: calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca, no dejes el camino y camina. Calma y respira, mira pa'lante y sigue, no cedas, traga saliva. Calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca con eso de las cosas de la vida. Calma y respira, mira pa'lante y sigue, no te dejes caer, respira. Un nuevo mantra para sanarte el alma, respira. Lo llevo tatuado en un brazo y en el otro calma, respira. A mí la música también me salva, respira. Me saca la puta depresión, me limpia el karma, respira. Levántate y anda, respira. Aunque estés sola o en banda, respira. Respira y calma, calma, respira. En pelagato, la miche. Calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca, no dejes el camino y camina. Calma y respira, mira pa'lante y sigue, no cedas, traga saliva. Calma y respira, aunque te estés volviendo loca, con eso de las cosas.
That was Miss Bolivia, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the opera Zavala Zavala with Ana Dini Morales, who's a librettist of the upcoming opera Zavala Zavala, as well as a Latin American Studies Fellow in the Humanities and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. We're also speaking with Sergio Garcia, who's an Assistant Federal Public Defender for the Western District of Texas. So it's quite interesting that we're having this conversation here because, to my understanding, Sergio Garcia, you've actually had a chance to speak with Natividad following the development of this opera based on her life, her real life here, her real life situation. What has been her response of this particular interpretation of her story? You know, I'm sure it's not necessarily something that one would jump for joy considering all the realized circumstances. It's, I guess, for lack of a better term, bittersweet. But I want to get your thoughts on what she has said and the fact that you even stayed in contact with her over the years since.
Yes, you know, perhaps the most important thing that I have taken from my conversations with Ms. Zavala is that two things. She knows she hasn't been forgotten. And most important, through the great work of Ana, and I can't just praise her enough, somebody cared. Somebody cared. I remember after the case got done, I went to see her at her cell. And I said, I'm sorry. I came up short. And it was hard because, you know, as an immigrant, and I know there is all sorts of discriminations, I know that the thing that I leaned on in this case particularly is in process. She had the right to process. She had the constitutional protected right to seek asylum, and she was not given process. The system failed, didn't care. And to have Ana display all kinds of kindness and care, and the fact that she hasn't been forgotten, I think those Those are the most things, the remarkable things that I have taken from my conversations with her, that what happened to her, we're not going to be silent about it. And that somebody cared, somebody who she didn't know, she had no contact with Anna, and somebody, you know, as far as you can go from El Paso, right? Somebody just grabbed her pen and started to write. I mean, I think it's just, you know, I mean, I have a lot of heroes, but certainly Anna is one of them, so.
Dios mío.
Yeah.
Well, Sergio, I just want to say that here, it's you, okay? And everybody like you who's on the front line working all of the time. And, you know, people like Kids in Need of Defense, Catherine Donato, all these people who do this work on the front lines.
Sergio, when I look at the timeline again from the El Paso Times, and I have to say, this is one of the few publications that actually focus on what took place here with this particular case. I'm a little surprised now that her story isn't a lot more well-known than it is right now, because as we mentioned before, this came out in 2017, right around the time when zero tolerance still wasn't known throughout the country. And so I guess the question for you here, are you surprised that this hasn't gotten a lot more attention than it's gotten thus far? Like I said before, we could point to 1,000 other Zavala type cases, but because this was one of the first ones, I imagine, or I would assume, that this would have a lot greater awareness than it does right now.
Yeah, I think you're correct. And I'm also surprised. I think the only way I can explain it is that it's an embarrassment. You know, these judges should be ashamed of the way they ruled against these people and against this particular woman, Zavala. They should be embarrassed. They should be ashamed. They went to law school like I did. And they learned right from wrong, legal from illegal. And depriving somebody who's innocent, because your presumption of innocence, depriving you from process. I mean, that's the reason why we have a right to be heard. And in such a fashion, I can only help but think, you know, what would happen if she was from Canada, if she was from a different country. And, you know, I like not to think that the color of your skin really makes a difference, at least in the court system. And I'm an optimist, obviously. I know better. But, you know, just such a shame. You know, these judges who I argue, I see them almost every day. And I would like to, you know, see one of those judges and say, hey, did you want to ask me a question about Ms. Zavala? Did you care? This was it just a number? So yeah, I'm surprised that it hasn't received the attention that it should receive. And I'm so excited because I think Anna is hoping to bring this work into El Paso. And because, you know, you're right. I mean, it has made some sound in the East Coast, you know, in this D.C. And it's making, you know, we're right now talking to you from a radio station in D.C. But we need this story to be told here because this is where it happened. And people, the authorities here, the immigration officers and the judges want to look away. They don't really want to talk about this. But when if Anna brings this here, I'm going to buy them some tickets, see if they want to go see what they did. It would be great, you know, because I think you need to own your decisions, especially your judicial decisions. You need to own them. You need to make it, you know, when I, as a lawyer, when I make a decision to defend a client in a certain fashion, I need to own my decision. And if we lose because I made a mal decision, I'm going to own it. And these judges looked away. I guarantee you that if I were to ask the judge who decided the El Paso 5 here, the district judge, tell me the 5 names of the people that you separated, that you helped separate from the children. Tell me the 5 names. I guarantee you 10 to 1 that they will have a hard time. It's just a shame. And I'm surprised. But again, you know, I know Anna is very humble, and you know, but that's a characteristic from somebody who's great, right? I mean, they're humble, and she's humble, and she just, you know, I'm so thankful. I think, you know, Ms. Zavala had some people who helped her, but I can't emphasize enough that her case would be completely silenced and dead, and it would have been filed away a long time ago had it not been for Anna. And I know that Anna said that it's about me, but no, I mean, she's the voice. She actually kept it alive, and we're still making noise and telling people. And I can't wait until the people in El Paso, the residents, the citizens in El Paso, see what their judges are doing, because they don't know.
And allow me to reiterate something I said earlier, which is that even now, as we have this conversation, there has been no declaration by the current administration saying that all these families that were separated, all these children that were separated from their parents during this time period have been reunited. The resolution has not been met. It has not been reached. It has not been finalized. And we cannot forget the images of children in cages, literal cages, during that time period. And we're not talking about something that happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It's in the recent past, not that far from where we are right now, which is also quite astonishing as well. And so let's not forget the images of the kids in cages, the kids in these aluminum blankets as they were seen, sleeping on the floor. That may be, for all we know, still happening right now, so long as families are still separated at this present moment in time. Correct, Sergio?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. I'm sure that there is things that still are happening. And you're right. There is children that are still missing. They haven't really been reunited. I think the last time I read an article, some statistics were over 1,000 children who are still haven't been reunited. Yeah. Yeah. You're correct.
It's astonishing. And there's a part of me that's like wants to scream out loud when I hear these things. And also a part of me that wants to scream when I don't hear anything, that no resolution has been met, that no answers have been made with regards to families that were separated several years ago. So I'm curious to know, Sergio, what else do you hope people learn from this story of Natividad Zavala Zavala? It seems like it's a Pandora's box of a story that should have been more well known than it is right now. And it opens up a whole other can of worms, in my opinion, as it pertains to the rights of migrants, the rights of asylum seekers, even as we have this conversation right now with recent actions by this current administration. What else do you hope people learn from the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala?
Well, I hope that they learn that they need to, and I hate to say this, but because I was talking to my wife about this the other day, we need to know about more about our judges. We need to know about these people who are making decisions. I mean, when I went to law school, you know, I thought the Supreme Court of the United States was the closest you can get to have God make decisions, you know, fair, just, maybe decisions you won't like. But the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability, the unethical practices, as I said to you, here in El Paso, citizens don't know, the residents of El Paso, a lot of people, they don't know why about El Paso 5. And if they would only know, I have confidence in the citizens of El Paso that they would side with me and say, this was wrong. This was wrong. The judge, you know, these judges, they are appointed for life. And they have the authority and the capacity to order the U.S. Marshals to get in a plane, fly to Honduras, and get Ms. Zavala back. And they have that much power. They're just, you know, they're appointed for life. That's the power they have. And the power that they have was abused, misused. And the citizens who go and cast their votes, they need to know about these people. They need to know about these people. We don't know about them. It's in the dark. You know, the fact that they say they were unaccompanied minors, they were not. They were created. They were separating the parents so they could prosecute the parents. And then they said, well, they were unaccompanied minors. No, they were not. Let's set the record straight. They showed up with their parents, with their grandma, Zavala Zavala. So they do a lot of shady stuff, a lot of crazy stuff. And I think citizens, they need to learn to be aware. And certainly as we come close to the elections, we need to be educated, because there is people making big time decisions, decisions that affect people's lives, destroy people's lives. And they're in the dark. So we need to at least bring them out. At least bring them out and be informed.
Absolutely. And I've tried my best during my whole line of questioning during the course of this conversation to not be too political. But sometimes your very existence can be political. In this case, we're talking about asylum seekers and people seeking refuge. And unfortunately, the reality of the world shows us that a lot of people who are making political decisions are doing it with no humanity in mind whatsoever. And the case of Natividad Zavala Zavala is just one case that proves it. If not one case, it may be the case that was at the forefront at the beginning of public awareness of this zero tolerance policy. And again, I want to stress this again, that people should be more aware of this case more than they should, more than they have already. So Ana Dini Morales, I want to get your final thoughts as well with regards to what people should learn about this particular case.
Dino, I agree with what Sergio is saying about, he said, our judges. And for me, it was thinking about, because a lot of people have asked, you know, I'm an East Coast Latina Boricua, right? And so people have said to me, well, why are you writing about the border? And for me, it was, I was writing about something that my legal system is doing and has done and needs to reckon with. So this is my legal system as someone living in the United States. And so I think people need to be aware of their system, what their system is doing. And then the other thing is we need to have solidarity as Latinx, Latinx, Latinas, and Latinos. You know, we need to have solidarity in our communities. And it's interesting, like, one thing I did say about Gabriela Mistral is she felt that language, your language could welcome you. You know, like language has that ability. And I believe the stage has that ability to be a place where people come home. And so I'm hoping that this work, well, many works are that for many people. So, you know, we need to learn of the stage and writing or whatever work of art is as a place where people find home, a place that welcomes what has happened and welcomes different people. And regarding what you said before, I want to give a shout out to Kids in Need of Defense, because they have been working, pressuring the Biden administration to take responsibility for what happened during the previous administration, right? And so people are really working hard on trying to find help for children. First of all, finding children who have been disappeared. As Sergio was saying, I remember that number as well, you know, over 1,000, but it really, the numbers really don't matter. Even if it happens to one person, right? If it's you, if it's your child, if it's your neighbor, right? Well, we can't think of numbers as reflecting the need for mercy or the need to pay attention to something. And then, do you know, like people like Jason De Leon, who's an anthropologist who works on presenting the need for empathy at the border, Valeria Luiselli, who wrote The Lost Children's Archive, and I mentioned Javier Zamora before. You know, there are a lot of people paying attention to this problem. And then the last thing I was thinking, this issue of shame, and that's at the center of this work. Well, I interviewed many, many people to write this work, from people who had migrated to people who work in legal systems and judges. And 99% of them did not want me to use their names. The people that were okay with us using their names were Sergio Garcia and the Zavalas. We got their consent to include their names in the work. One of the issues that came up was this idea of a slight line shifting during this administration. And that line shifting basically changed a sense of, and this is what a lawyer told me that I interviewed for this piece, that it changed the sense of what was right and what was wrong. And it gave me the sense that there was like the people have a threshold of shame. As we get older and we are caught up in what our boss thinks and what our peers think and what the neighbors and get it on, right? And what we're going to get out of if we do this or that, there's a threshold of shame. And what you said earlier, like these were perfectly well-meaning people that woke up in the morning and found themselves having to make a decision. And that became a threshold for them that they never expected to cross, probably. You know, probably in law school, if that issue, as Sergio talks about law school, you know, if that issue had come up, what would you do? What would you defend of your government? Would you defend your government disappearing a child? And they would probably say, no, I wouldn't do that. Would you agree with that, Sergio?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. 100%.
So what's happening as people age and they lose a sense of these ideas of hope that they had when they were young, the recognition that what's most important is to be held and to be close and to be near people you love, and that we need that. You know, it's almost as if we as people need to remember what it is to be a child, our own child, and then recognize that's what children need. So this will be performed at Gala Hispanic Theater in Washington, D.C. on June 21st and 22nd at 8 p.m. and on the 23rd at 2 p.m. And we have really excellent speakers who will be there also after the performances, including Sergio Garcia, Catherine Donato, Maria Otero, Amy Morales, many people who will have an opportunity to converse with the audience and afterwards. And we also have incredible performers, in addition to Brian Ariola, who's the composer, who will be leading the chamber ensemble. We have Efraín Solís, a wonderful Mexican baritone, Elizabeth Mondragon, and Judy Giannini, who will be performing, and Abraham Latner, who will play the role of El Niño.
Fantastic. As we have this conversation today, organizations like the ACLU and other immigrant rights organizations are already putting a legal battle towards the Biden administration, towards their current decisions, and fighting the good fight to make sure that cases like that of Zavala don't increase as time goes on. That's what legal organizations can do with regards to this administration, and what the arts and humanities can do is not only raise awareness to the story itself, but also bring shame to the people that made these horrendous decisions in the first place. So with that said, we've been speaking with Ana Dini Morales, who's a librettist of the opera Zavala, and also a Latin American Studies Fellow in the Humanities and adjunct professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Ana Dini Morales, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Gracias. Gracias, Oscar.
Absolutely. And we've also been speaking with Sergio Garcia, who's an assistant federal public defender for the Western District of Texas. Thank you for sharing your story and for being with us on the show today, Sergio Garcia.
Thank you, Oscar. And thank you, Ana, for being
Gracias, Sergio. Gracias a ti.
Gracias.
Fantastic. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Spangert Drowns with some brief news headlines. Political leaders in South Africa announced a coalition government today, ending 30 years of majority rule by the African National Congress. The ANC, still the largest party in South Africa, joined with its biggest rival, the white-led pro-business Democratic Alliance Party, to form the coalition government. The leader of the Democratic Alliance said it will, quote, co-govern in a spirit of unity and collaboration. Two smaller conservative parties will also join the government. President Cyril Ramaphosa of the ANC is expected to win another term in office, while another ANC official was elected as the National Assembly's speaker. Reuters reports that a Democratic Alliance official will receive the position of deputy speaker as part of the coalition deal. Italy is hosting a G7 summit of wealthy nations this week, where the United States and its European allies agreed to use interest generated from Russian assets frozen in Europe to secure a $50 billion loan for Ukraine. The Associated Press is reporting that G7 leaders will issue a statement today, leaving the door open to confiscating all of the $260 billion in frozen Russian assets. U.S. President Biden also met with Ukrainian President Zelensky at the summit to sign a 10-year security agreement pledging military assistance to Kyiv without committing U.S. troops. The pact is an executive agreement, not a treaty ratified by Congress, which means it could be overturned if Donald Trump wins the White House in November. A federal court in Louisiana yesterday temporarily suspended education department rules protecting transgender students against discrimination in schools, finding a legal challenge to the rules will likely prevail. The rules, issued in April, interpret the Title IX law against sex-based discrimination in schools as prohibiting discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Four states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Idaho, challenged the law. An education department spokesperson said it stands by the rules and will continue to, quote, fight for every student. The U.S. Supreme Court this morning struck down a ban on bump stocks, which are gun accessories that convert semi-automatic weapons into what are effectively machine guns. The Trump-era bump stock ban was implemented following the 2017 Las Vegas mass shooting, in which the gunman used a bump stock to fire more than 1,000 rounds into a crowd, killing 60 people and injuring hundreds more. The Supreme Court found that the Trump administration failed to follow federal law when it banned the gun accessory. The court is also considering a case challenging a federal law keeping guns away from people under domestic violence restraining orders. In 2022, the court issued a landmark decision that expanded gun rights, saying gun laws must follow the country's, quote, historical tradition of firearm regulation. And according to the National Weather Service, an extreme heat wave, now centered on the Southwest, will build in the central U.S. on Sunday and spread into the Midwest and Northeast by Monday. The heat wave could continue through Wednesday. In a typical year, extreme heat is the top weather-related killer in the U.S., taking about 1,200 lives annually. The first heat wave of the season carries heightened health risks, since people are not yet accustomed to the high temperatures. Studies have shown that human-caused climate change is making heat waves more likely, more intense, and longer-lasting. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 87 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 83 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Spangert Drowns. Thanks for listening.